and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and today's program will be featuring articles from Quartz.com, from the Washington Post, from Scientific American, and more. Today's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. We'll begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article dated February 26th, published on Quartz.com, and the article is titled, How Religion is Playing a Role in the Spread of Coronavirus in Korea. This article is by Isabella Steger, the deputy editor of Asia for Quartz. Religion is at the center of many lives in Korea. Now it's at the center of a rapidly spreading contagion. The largest number of COVID-19 infections outside of China is now in Korea. Health officials there have confirmed more than 1,000 cases, and the virus has so far killed 11 people. About half those cases are linked to the Shincheonji Church of Jesus, a group the government describes as a cult, prompting officials to test all 200,000 of its followers. Authorities linked another cluster of cases to a church in the southern city of Busan, and yet another to a group of Catholic pilgrims returning from Israel. The virus also infected a number of people at the Myeongseong megachurch in Seoul, which has 80,000 congregants. In response, the Catholic Church today suspended all masses in Korea. Buddhist temples and Protestant churches around the country have also suspended religious gatherings. Shincheonji halted its services too. The moves to limit religious activity in Korea are by no means specific to Korea. Churches and temples in Singapore and Hong Kong have made similar decisions. But organized religion has played a far bigger role in the spread of COVID-19 in Korea. Explaining the linkages between religion and the outbreak in Korea, Francis Jaerong Song, a professor in sociology at Kyunghee University in Seoul, described the country as a zealous Christian state. She said many Korean Christians have an evangelical mindset, and their religious activities, like attending worship sessions and outreach multiple times a week, and their unwillingness to curb those activities, may have led to the large-scale spread of the contagion. About 30% of Korea's 50 million people identify as Christian, according to some estimates. The church is also politically active in Korea and exerts a powerful influence on government policy. The impact of Korean evangelicals is also felt strongly abroad. The country sends the second largest number of missionaries overseas. In the context of the coronavirus, that religious fervor in Korea has played a role. A former member of Shincheonji told the New York Times that members were told not to be afraid of sickness and focus only on converting more followers. Now, as the virus tears through the Shincheonji community, the municipal government in Seoul has banned all of the sect gatherings in the capital. Even as the virus spreads, and after the Korean government advised the public against mass gatherings, some have continued to attend church, and not all churches in Korea have canceled services. Paul Cha, an expert on Korean history and religion at the University of Hong Kong, emphasized the importance of church-going as a ritual for many Korean Christians. It constitutes an important part of your faith and devotion. Unless you're really sick on your deathbed, you go to church, he said. He added, however, that Koreans may also be more likely to continue going to group activities, as they do not have the social memory of living through SARS, as people in Hong Kong did in 2003. Jun Kwang-hoon, a populist reverend known for his fervent conservatism and criticism of the left-leaning national government, has been particularly outspoken since the coronavirus reached Korea, illustrating how religion and politics, and now health, often intersect in Korea. Defying a ban against large gatherings, he led an anti-government rally in central Seoul on February 22nd, where he told the crowd, mostly older Koreans, that God would cure them of the disease if they caught it, and that it was patriotic to die from the virus, the Korean Herald reported. Seoul's mayor later questioned Jun's sanity on a radio program. One elderly attendee, who risked a fine of $2,500 for attending the rally, told the Voice of America that government bans on public protests were just another form of political suppression. Authorities arrested the Reverend on Monday on unrelated charges. The Reverend had said he was planning another mass protest this coming weekend to call for the resignation of Korea's president, but has since called it off. Our next piece in Religion in the News this week is a commentary from Scientific American, by Abraham Loeb, who is the chair of the astronomy department at Harvard University, the founding director of Harvard's Black Hole Initiative, and director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. The title of this commentary is When Lab Experiments Carry Theological Implications. The subheadline, Efforts to Create New Life Forms and New Universes, will raise profound questions. The creation of the universe and of life within it are the two fundamental pillars of the story of divine Genesis in the opening chapter of the Bible. But suppose we were able to create a baby universe in the laboratory or produce synthetic life out of raw chemicals. Would that make us contenders for the title of God? And even if we dismiss these prospects as unrealistic with our current technologies, another civilization that happened to be billions of years more technologically advanced than we are might have accomplished these feats and created our universe or life in a laboratory. Should we regard such a civilization as our God? I ask these questions not out of philosophical curiosity, but because related experiments are being discussed in the scientific literature. For example, a team led by Nobel laureate Jack Sostak at Harvard is aiming to construct a synthetic cellular system that undergoes Darwinian evolution. Their building block of synthetic life, a primitive cell, consists of a self-replicating genetic polymer, analogous to a natural genome, surrounded by a self-replicating membrane, analogous to a natural cell boundary. The genetic polymer carries information that allows replication and variation, enabling new generations of synthetic cells to possess qualities that are inherited but can also evolve. The membrane protects and separates the identity of this information from the outside world. Synthetic life experiments may explain the chemistry and physics behind Darwinian evolution on Earth, but they also hold the promise to explore conditions different from those realized through the restricted geological and atmospheric conditions on Earth. Chefs know very well that the same ingredients can be used to make different cakes, depending on the quantity, order, and timing of putting them together, as well as the environmental conditions, such as temperature and surface conditions, in which they were mixed. Earth demonstrated a particular recipe for life, but it may be only one out of a large set of possible recipes. Studying the variety of possible life forms in the laboratory could expand our imagination as to which cosmic environments in the sky might harbor life. It would be revolutionary if some of these potentially habitable environments were distinctly different from the surfaces of Earth-like planets with which astronomers are currently obsessed. Such a realization could shape the search for extraterrestrial life in much the same way as experiments that led to the discovery of quantum mechanics guided the study of stars, galaxies, and the rest of the universe. Just as better understanding of the laws of physics enabled modern technologies that serve our daily needs, creating synthetic life in the laboratory could yield tremendous side benefits to medicine and biomedical research. But another type of laboratory experiment could shed new light on our understanding of the birth of the entire cosmos. According to the prevailing cosmological model, our universe started from a period of cosmic inflation, during which a microscopic region of space was stretched by tens of orders of magnitude because of a temporary domination of the vacuum energy density, similarly to the accelerated cosmic expansion we are witnessing at the present time. The vacuum density stems from the existence of a quantum field called the inflation. Physicists can study ways of artificially producing a region of space where the inflated field is concentrated to a level that would stimulate the creation of a baby universe. Such a baby universe would not expand into the laboratory, but rather branch off from the space-time of its creators and evolve in its own bubble. This raises the question of whether the Big Bang could have been the results of a laboratory experiment, and if so, will we ever know? Such an origin for our universe does not resolve the fundamental question about our cosmic roots, but only pushes the question back in time by one generation of experimentalists. Even if this were the case, we are left to wonder, what created the experimentalists who inflated our universe? Perhaps they resulted from an earlier generation of experimentalists and so on and so forth. Without an end, with our civilization capable of following this cosmic tradition by producing baby universes in the future. Asking how it all started may resemble asking who came first, the chicken or the egg. But perhaps just as in the chicken and egg dilemma, for the beginning of which we have scientific clues, the entire cosmic history started from some primordial ingredients and random processes. In which case, one may ask, are there recipes for different universes that can be produced out of the same primordial ingredients? If so, we could broaden our perspective by reading the Book of Recipes for Universes. When we meet members of a more advanced civilization, we might ask if they wrote such a book. If they did, let's hope that it's available for purchase, and not out of print. Our next article this week comes from the Washington Post, and it's got a great headline, Can Catholics Eat the Impossible Burger During Lent? Sure, but it's kind of missing the point. This is by Marissa Iotti of the Washington Post. For as long as religious dietary guidelines have existed, somewhere there has likely been at least one moderately devoted practitioner desperately searching for loopholes. But the advent of technology that enables non-meat products to taste more like meat than ever poses a fresh ethical question that's particularly relevant this time of year. Can Catholics in good conscience eat plant-based meat substitutes like the Impossible Burger during Lent? I will be honest, when someone asked me that, my first thought was, why didn't I think of that? It's genius. The Reverend Marlon Mendieta of St. Patrick Catholic Church in Fayetteville, North Carolina, wrote in an email. But then my conscience kicked in, and I just felt that I wouldn't be okay with that. The Catholic Church instructs members to abstain from meat on Ash Wednesday and Fridays during Lent, a season of penitence and renewal leading up to Easter. The practice of foregoing meat dates to the early church, when meat was considered a luxury, and is meant to be an act of self-discipline. The question of whether plant-based burgers count as meat may sound silly, but it offers insight into how people of faith think about their dietary rules and traditions as food technology rapidly advances. Although plant-based meat is a much smaller industry than traditional meat, plant-based meat sales increased roughly 10% in the year leading up to April 2019, according to the Good Food Institute, which advocates for plant-based alternatives to animal products. Executives of Impossible Foods, the company that makes the Impossible Burger, don't know whether Lent coincided with an uptick in sales last year because the startup is constantly growing, said Rachel Conrad, a spokeswoman for Impossible. She said some restaurants do encourage patrons to try the Impossible Burger during Lent, so the company expects it could see a bump in orders this time of year. Representatives of Beyond Meat, the company that produces the popular plant-based Beyond Burger, did not respond Thursday to a request for comment about how their Lenten burger sales stack up. To Mendieta, whether a Catholic should pass over the Impossible or Beyond Burgers in the grocery store in the spirit of self-control is a huge question mark. So he said he took an informal poll of his priest friends. If it's not meat, it's not meat, one friend reportedly responded, ushering a sigh of relief from Catholic omnivores everywhere. Seems like it goes against the spirit of the penitential season if we just eat things that taste like the stuff we're supposed to be abstaining from, said another priest, putting the kibosh on meat eaters' momentary joy. Ultimately, Mendieta said the decision is a matter of personal conscience. Plant-based burgers are not meat, he said, but eating them because they offer a technical exemption to the rule is kind of missing the point. Unless there's a medical reason, like an allergy to fish, which Catholics commonly substitute for meat during Lent. Still, the church generally cares more about whether eating a certain food is a sacrifice than about whether it's technically meat, said Michael Foley, a patristics professor at Baylor University. Church leaders let Catholics in part of Michigan eat muskrat, for example, because it's considered less desirable than other animals. On the other hand, Foley said St. Augustine of Hippo used to criticize wealthy 4th century believers who on Fridays during Lent ate extravagant seafood, which does not count as meat. Abstaining from meat is also meant to be tied to almsgiving or donating to charity, Foley said. Catholics are supposed to give to people in need whatever money they save by not buying meat during Lent. If a plant-based burger costs as much as or more than a burger made from meat, Foley said, the charitable part of the tradition is missing. A year-round vegetarian, the Reverend Christopher Steck sometimes eats plant-based meat substitutes along with other types of veggie burgers. But Steck, a theology professor at Georgetown University, said he often substitutes peanut butter sandwiches on Fridays during Lent because he considers the meal's simplicity to be a sacrifice. Although Steck said eating plant-based burgers could break with the spirit of abstinence from meat, he added that Catholics could justify that choice if they made it for reasons of sustainability. Pope Francis has appealed to all people to care for the environment and protect the Earth's future. If that's their motivation for a plant-based burger, Steck said, to me there's a nice symbol in that. For those hoping to replicate the taste of meat this Lent, David Cluche, a moral theology professor at Catholic University, offered a resolutely uplifting perspective. They're 100% in the clear. Catholics should ask themselves whether eating a plant-based burger represents a sacrifice for them, Cluche said. Even if it doesn't, he said it still adheres to the letter of the law, which is meant to remind Catholics that it is Lent. But if someday scientists start growing burgers from animal cells in a laboratory, Cluche said, Catholics will have to redefine meat all over again. Next on Religion in the News this week is an article from Religion News Service dated February 24th. The title, Solidarity Over Segregation, Faith-Based Coalitions Organize Across Races, Religions. This is by Matthew J. Kressler and Adele M. Banks of Religion News Service. And we might need to edit this briefly for time, but shouldn't have to edit too much, I hope. It begins with this note. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. described 11 o'clock on Sunday morning as the most segregated hour in America. This story is one in a series by Religion News Service about the future of segregation and integration in American religion, produced in partnership with Sacred Rights, a project that helps scholars share their research with a broader audience. Rachel Prestipino knows how segregated Miami can be every day, including Sunday. It's not just at 11 a.m. But one thing all groups in Miami share, said Prestipino, lead organizer for a local faith-based organization called People Acting for Community Together, is an interest in solving local problems. That desire, for whatever reason, goes across all these lines of differences, whether that's faith, background, or race. PACT has helped Christians, Jews, and Muslims in her community overcome their racial, ethnic, and faith divides outside of their congregations. More than a half century after the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. challenged the Christian church to remove the yoke of segregation from its own body, an estimated one-sixth of U.S. congregations have succeeded in becoming at least partly multiracial, but not without struggles. A handful of religious institutions, meanwhile, are pursuing reconciliation by pushing for reparations. But in more than 100 U.S. cities, people of faith are choosing to come together across historic racial and religious boundaries, not at the congregational or even denominational level, but by mobilizing outside of weekly worship services to address daily problems where they live. Even if racial reconciliation is not the primary purpose of these nonpartisan coalitions, a byproduct of their work is often relationships with people who do not look or believe as they do. Indiana University sociologist Brad Fulton, who directs the National Study of Community Organizing, said the number of faith-based community organizing coalitions has increased from 201 to 222 in the past 5 years alone. 8% of U.S. congregations are affiliated with a community organizing network, such as the Direct Action Research Training Center, Faith in Action, or the Industrial Areas Foundation. A DART affiliate, PACT was founded to serve Miami-Dade County 32 years ago, and today represents the 50,000 members of 40 congregations, including Black, White, and Latino churches, two synagogues, and a mosque. DART has 22 member organizations in 8 states, including 9 other groups like PACT in Florida alone. PACT works much like secular grassroots community organizations. Its local activists stage rallies, research best practices around issues like implementing restorative justice in public schools and securing affordable housing, and hold public officials accountable for addressing them, sometimes by showing up at their offices en masse to demand change. In one current project, PACT is advocating for a community identification card for Owl County residents. There are people, the undocumented, youth in foster care, the elderly, that have barriers to access without IDs, said Prestipino, who said ID cards can be an equalizer and inclusive force. Fulton said collaborations across race, religion, and class identities not only foster relationships within coalitions, but impress political leaders who see a wide range of support on the issues they work on together. If you could present to the politicians or show up at a meeting with a mayor with a broad-based coalition, you're just going to be much more effective in getting the issue addressed than if you're just one organization representing one constituency, he said. That gives PACT outsized influence in Miami's intensely multicultural but deeply segregated context, where politics often operate by pitting its ethnic and racial communities against one another. PACT works to combat those divisions. We believe that we serve a God of abundance and that we can all win, said Prestipino, who has led the organization since 2016. In God's city, we would all have an affordable home to live in, and we don't have to fight against each other for that. The group's unity extends to which prayers and scriptures it chooses to cite. One verse we use often is Micah 6:8, Prestipino noted, referring to a passage in which the Hebrew biblical prophet Micah urges Israel to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. This is part of the Hebrew scriptures, the Christian tradition, and Micah is recognized as a prophet by Muslims as well, said Prestipino. As much as religion has separated the races in America, people of faith have long overcome their racial differences to fight injustice. In the civil rights era, some white Christians and Jews worked with black churches on access to the ballot. And with the Supreme Court's decision to end certain sections of the Voting Rights Act, the cause of voter protection has become a rallying point again for white and black clergy. The Reverend Adam R. Taylor, a black Baptist minister and executive director of the social justice organization Sojourners, says he has seen an increasing commitment to interracial organizing and interreligious engagement by churches. Now, some of those trends have kind of ebbed and flowed, but I think in particular we've seen in some of our work around trying to protect the right to vote and voter protection, a lot of white allies wanting to come alongside black churches and engage in that work, said Taylor, author of Mobilizing Hope, Faith-Inspired Activism for a Post-Civil Rights Generation. More recently, white and Asian clergy have joined their African-American colleagues to counter police violence and white nationalism, he said. One of the most well-known recent examples of multi-faith coalitions was created in Charlottesville, Virginia, in response to an outburst of racial violence in 2017, after the Charlottesville City Council voted to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee and rename Lee Park. During what activists dubbed the Summer of Hate, torch-bearing white nationalists marched on the University of Virginia campus in opposition to the council's decision in May. The Ku Klux Klan scheduled a rally in downtown Charlottesville for July, and a Unite the Right rally was planned for August 12th. Some people of color grew increasingly frustrated as local religious leaders debated how their congregations should respond. Should clergy and congregations ignore neo-Nazis or directly confront them? As the debate went on, said Jelaine Schmidt, a University of Virginia professor and Black Lives Matter member who identifies as a queer black woman and as a Catholic, it set up this dynamic that you can't count on the clergy. This led the Reverend Brittany Kane Conley and the Reverend Seth Wispelway, young white ministers ordained by the United Church of Christ, to co-found Congregate Charlottesville. Realizing that people of faith were not prepared to demonstrate any sort of resistance to white supremacist violence, Kane Conley recalled, Congregate Charlottesville began hosting nonviolent direct action trainings in the weeks leading up to August 12. Many of us across traditions felt that there is really no greater importance than that of presence, Kane Conley said. Despite pleas from city officials and the police, who discouraged confronting the white supremacists, Congregate decided we couldn't just stay away and simply pray, said Kane Conley. On the morning of August 12th, clergy and dozens of black and white Christians, Jews, and Muslims gathered in the sanctuary of First Baptist Church, then marched from the historic black church to confront the white supremacists. The group included national religious leaders, such as the Reverend Osagyefo Sekou, Cornell West, Lisa Sharon Harper, and the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. It really was a turning point for a lot of folks in the United States, Kane Conley recalled. It really woke folks up. Congregate published a national call to conscience in the days that followed, challenging people of faith to embrace love and join the fight against white supremacy. Charlottesville also showed, however, that faith-based organization has yet to go beyond an activist core. The majority of those who put their bodies and lives on the line were people of color, were people of marginalized religious identities, Jewish and Muslim, said Kane Conley. It was queer folks, and it was women. In the days before the rally, Kane Conley and Wispelway had invited 1,000 clergy to Charlottesville to confront white supremacy, reminiscent of King's 1965 request for clergy to come to Alabama after white police and vigilantes brutally beat civil rights activists as they attempted to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. "We really were attempting to call on white clergy, particularly white male clergy, to put their bodies on the line in ways that marginalized people are forced to every day," said Kane Conley. 1,000 clergy did not come. Even most Charlottesville clergy stayed home. If King's challenge was then to a largely Christian church-going nation, today the effort at desegregation is equally aimed at including members of other faiths and immigrant populations of color. In 2017, Imam Mohammed Omar, executive director of Darul Ar Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota, decided it was no longer prudent to remain isolated after members of an Illinois militia threw a pipe bomb into his mosque. Joining forces with other imams in the area, Omar, a refugee from war-torn Somalia, approached Isaiah, a 20-year-old mostly white and Christian community-based organizing coalition from St. Paul. Through a week-long training with Isaiah, Omar discovered the struggles of other people of faith, and other Isaiah trainees in turn saw the pain his congregation had endured. "When some of us suffer, all of us will suffer," Omar told the Faith, Race, and Politics Conference in Cincinnati in July. In the wake of the bombing, Isaiah members and others in the community developed a political response to Islamophobia that included a report on anti-Muslim propaganda in their state. Isaiah's executive director, Duran Schrantz, said the group, which has engaged black churches since its start and has included a Latinx coalition for 6 years, has grown from a predominantly Christian to a multi-faith coalition with a Muslim cohort of some 20 mosques. Black barbershops and Somali child care centers are now among its institutional members from cities and rural areas across the state. Isaiah, a Faith in Action affiliate, now connects 250,000 people in Minnesota, 60% of whom are white and 40% of whom are people of color. Isaiah recently won a significant victory. A state sentencing commission in January approved a 5-year maximum probation for most felonies. Omar, whose community is awaiting the trial of the alleged ringleader of the attack on his mosque, said working with Isaiah has brought together people who might be uncomfortable with the singing or praying of an interfaith service on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. They could more easily come together on championing the 5-year probation limit. "That is something I can literally bring my people and say, this is what's happening," said Omar in an interview. "I'm not taking you to an interfaith dinner. I'm taking you to work that can change your life and my life and our neighbor's life." And that's resonating with a lot of people. That'll do it for this week's episode of Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's broadcast has been generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and if you have a chance to catch up on earlier episodes of Religion in the News, you can do so by going to our website, ncreadingservice.com, and click on Podcasts, then find Religion in the News on the left side of the page. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.